Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
For show number 90, this is March 15th, 2021. Brief intro to today's show. We're having on award-winning author Gigi Vandegrift, and she wrote a novel called An Oxford Murder. We'll be with her shortly. And now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there on the internet. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Just go over there and like us over there. And you can find the reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasridell.net. That's thomasridell.net. And the on-demand shows can be found there also on the podcast page as well. So if you don't want to do that, you can go over to the Blog Talk Radio site, of course, and search for it over there, The Writer's Lounge. That would be us. And if you would like to, you can find me on Twitter at TomRidell56. And our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be on the show and you have a book, you'd like your book reviewed, and you want to be a guest, just put guest response in the subject line and we'll get back to you. A special note here this week. We can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play the Writer's Lounge showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Reedsy Discovery. That's R-E-E-D-S-Y Discovery. They do a lot to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books over there as well. So that wraps up the show intro. And what we usually do at this time, what we will do at this time, is go into writer's topics. Every show we do have writer's topics right up until we introduce a special guest. Again, that would be Gigi Vandegrift, and she wrote An Oxford Murder. And also, if you'd like to call into the show to talk to me or Gigi, you can call us at area code 914-219-0868. And with that, let's get into writer's topics. George Saunders, an award-winning, highly acclaimed short story novelist and a professor of creative writing here at Syracuse University, went down to Google headquarters in 2013 and talked about his writing. And one topic he talked about was the editing process. He called it his inner nun syndrome, which I find kind of amusing, where he would micro-edit and chop down a very long piece of writing that he had worked on for years, but he decided to publish it. I found it interesting and a great little something to think about as we try to polish up our craft and to present stories that our readers will enjoy even more. If we just took the time to put a little more effort into our editing process, I think it would be great. So anyway, here's a 4-minute clip of George Saunders talking about editing during his talk at Google. And after that, after we listen to George, we'll come back and talk with author Gigi Vandegrift.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit about your editing process. Specifically, I read somewhere that Some Flicker Girl Diary started out as like a 200-page story and sort of evolved into like a 10-page story.
Yeah.
And I guess without spoiling it for everyone, I'm kind of wondering what got left out and how you decided.
Sure. So the question is about the editing process. And I had a story called The Semple Girl Diaries, which started in 98 and I finished it last spring. And it was up to some huge number of pages and got drastically cut. I you know, one of my things is I think as artists, we have to kind of submit to our neuroses a little bit. So often we think that to be an artist, you have to conquer your neuroses and be a perfectly calm, wonderful person. But my experience was rather you turn towards your tics and kind of go, okay, come on. So for me, I have a real, it's just like inner nun syndrome. Like I really don't like what I do. When I do it, I feel like, oh, Mr. Saunders, you know, what do you think you are, smarty pants? So that ends up to be kind of a, if you keep it in check, a pretty valuable editing tool. So for example, and I have a slight aversion, I've always had this since I was a kid, an aversion to what I consider banal language. Like, you know, when you're in grade school and they have those little readers, it's like, Jimmy was a bright, happy boy as he bounced into the room in the middle of a bright fall day. It actually kind of made me a little sick. There was something so unessential about it and kind of bleh. So for me, one of the things that I do is I'll get something up to a decent length pretty happily with that feeling that all is well. And then that inner nun thing will come in and kind of like speed it up. And I think the subtext of that is you respect your reader's intelligence. So I'll give you kind of an exaggerated example. If you have in a first draft something like Bob came happily into the room and sat down on the blue couch. Perfectly functional sentence, right? But it bugs me because you think, why does he have to sit down on a couch? Can you sit up on a couch? All right, well, let's cut the word down. Bob came happily into the room and sat on the blue couch. Why does he have to come into the room? Right? I mean, is there any meaning to him coming into the room? Not that we know of. Okay, cut. Bob, happily, I don't care. You know, we don't care about Bob's happiness. Bob sat on the blue couch. Blue? does blue signify? Not really, you know? Okay. Bob sat on the couch. Bob. Cut, you know? Cut it. So now we don't have much, but what we have is doesn't suck. We have Bob, you know. So in a sort of slightly less radical way, I apply that kind of thinking to the story. And the logic is, if I'm making those kind of really seem like nitpicky decisions, every time I do it, I'm honoring your intelligence a little bit. You know, that which you could assume, I'm going to assume that you're smart enough to assume. And in my model of reading, the whole thing is to get you stepping closer and closer and closer. Trusting me more and more. And in the process of trusting more, the fictive reality is becoming more three-dimensional. And, you get that magical fictional moment where you and the character aren't different and you can't sort of negotiate your way out of the cliff that's approaching. You know, and I think that process is done. One way it can be done is by this kind of micro-editing to assume intel. So on that story, you know, it was 180 pages, but at page 30, you were asleep. Basically, you know, there was no urgency in it. So then part of the job is just say, okay, those are just pages and now time to trim it back. You know, so, I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
Okay, again, that was George Saunders, and that was him talking about editing. And I think that a lot of us writers, when we get the first draft done, we get all excited. But the work really starts, I think, with the second draft. I know in my novel that I just published a few months ago, I probably went through 3 or 4 or 5 drafts before I got it the way I wanted it. And there was a lot of cutting, a lot of editing, a few little bits of addition. But for the most part, you have to make it so your readers are going to understand it better. And sometimes that means making it less wordy or maybe injecting a different adjective or whatever into the narrative or whatever. But if you take time and you spend the time to do it, it's gonna benefit you in the long run. So anyways, we're here today. And the main event, of course, is our guest, which is Gigi Vandegrift. She's an award-winning author, and she wrote An Oxford Murder. I believe it's one of her recent books that she's written. She's written several. But the book, An Oxford Murder, I wrote a review on it, and this is the review. It's a nightmare scenario that none of us ever want to experience. While searching for a missing colleague or friend, you finally end up finding them dead. This is a tale told in the noir-genre style, and the 1930s murder is served up as a mystery to be solved. The cast of characters and suspects are interesting, likable, and intriguingly amusing. The English dialogue was also delightfully colored, humorous, and highly entertaining. An example, she practically jingled with gold bangles and chains around her neck, and the act of being intimate, and another term was used as canoodling. The humor was well placed, but it never overshadowed the seriousness of the crime, of which Catherine and Harry were suspected of committing. It's a challenge to create a character and plot lines that are intended to continue into a series of books, but this seasoned author has no problem in generating interest. Catherine Tregone is determined in her pursuit of solving a crime, but she is also a romantic who struggles with an ongoing childhood love relationship. Another character plays for her affection in the course of the story, and this creates yet another interesting conflict, which forces Catherine into making a decision. This amorous subplot near the end of the book increased my rating of the story and boosted my curiosity in continuing on to the next 2 books in the series. Gigi Vandegrift continues to entertain. If you're a fan of noir crime mysteries, you'll love this one. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Gigi Vandegrift to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And
hi.
A little click of the button. There she is, hopefully. Are you there, Gigi?
Yes, I am.
Well, how are you?
I am. Hello. I'm doing well, thank you.
Very good, very good. I know you're a very busy lady these days, and we've tried to get a hold of you the last couple of weeks, but you have had life get in your way a little bit, but all is well on your side of the line.
Yes, everything's great. I'm editing my 4th novel in this series, so working hard.
Very good. And like to ask you, of course, you're an award-winning author of over 30 books, obviously an accomplished writer and author. Take us back, if you would, to that first time in front of a blank page. What was it like when you started your journey as an author, and who and what inspired you?
My first book that I wrote was not the first book I published. I always wanted, from the time I was an undergraduate at Stanford, I always wanted to write the story of Austria, where I lived for 6 months at Stanford in Austria. I wanted to write the story of what happened to them between World War I and World War II, because they lost their entire empire and they became a completely different entity. and then they got invaded by Hitler. How did that happen? You know, why did it happen? And so I had a story to tell that, as far as I know, has never been told in fiction. I have never read it anywhere, and I've read a lot of fiction from the period. So I had this desire to tell this story. On the other hand, it was kind of a Tolstoyan effort. It was going to demand much more than I had as a writer. And so I kind of put off the writing until for years while I researched. And then when I finally couldn't put it off any longer, I sat down and wrote my first chapter. And anyway, I was never, ever happy with it. It was just, it was very difficult. It was, didn't flow. I was too put off by the whole idea that people were going to judge me by my first paragraph. And that I thought I had to write something absolutely sensational for my first paragraph. And of course, that would put anybody off. But then I finally decided, I'm just not going to stick with my first chapter. I'm going to go on with the book, and maybe I will get into my writer consciousness, and I'll be able to go back and fool my body into thinking this isn't the first chapter, and I'll be able to write it without being worried, if you understand what I mean.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
So that was the story of how I got started. And it took me from the time I was 27 when I started it until I was in my 60s when I published it. I published other books in the meantime, but this was my great work, and it was over 500 pages, and it went through many, many, many iterations, and then I published it, and that's the book that ended up getting the award. And so it was actually my first book, but I had written an entire mystery series before I even published this, which qualifies as literary fiction. The book, it's called The Last Waltz.
Right.
And anyway, but I didn't stick with literary fiction. My real love was writing mysteries. And so that's what I've done.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the other day I was listening to some YouTube video, and they had some editors on talking about the craft. And one of the editors, when they were asked the question, what do you look for when you're editing a book, or when you're deciding, would be a publisher too. What do you look for in writing when you read somebody's manuscript? And one of the editors said that she can decide whether the book is good or not by the first couple paragraphs. And then the other editor said, no, it takes longer than that, but usually the first chapter works. So it's interesting that we spend so much time in our craft trying to hone our literary skills in that first couple paragraphs, like you did in your first book. But as I've always thought of, as far as writing, you just get it out of your head on the page and let the editing process take care of itself after the first draft is over with. And it sounds like you pretty much did that. You just let your consciousness flow, and that's very good. That's very good. In the Catherine Trigone series, hopefully I'm pronouncing her last name correct, which An Oxford Murder is the first book of, the story takes place in the 1930s. You mentioned about writing historical fiction. How much research does that entail to get the details right?
Well, I got my master's degree and my undergraduate degree in the interwar period in Europe. So as far as the setting goes, and I spent I spent quite a bit of time in Oxford and actually lived there, and my husband was taking a summer course there. And so, you know, I had Oxford in my head, and I also had all of the background, the European background, that I needed. But as far as tiny details, I was fairly dependent on the internet. Once I got past my memory, I had to, you know, use the internet to figure out. I couldn't remember what the grade, what the grades were in the police department, and I had to figure out where the police department was at Oxford in 1934. And I had a great big map, and I used that map to plot out her course when she was walking. I didn't know too much about the college where she was teaching because there was only one women's college in 1934, but I depended a lot on another mystery writer who had written a book very similar to mine. I kind of stole her idea, and that was Dorothy L. Sayers, who wrote the Lord Peter Wimsey series, and she set one of her books at Somerville College, where my book was set, and she called it something else, but that was, she was an alum of Somerville College, and so I used that book a lot in terms of finding out about the faculty, what offices there were in the faculty, what people, how students lived, you know, what their routine was, all that sort of thing. I don't think I could have written it without that book, because it was written in the exact period that my book took place in, and it was written in the exact place. And so that helped me tremendously. I've gone on from there, but that was the first book in the series.
Mm-hmm. And I know that I use it, but have you tried the tool Google Earth? That gives a good in a good view of, like, if you're doing a street view of an area that you're interested in, they give you details of the buildings around and even the flavor of the, you know, the place itself. Have you ever used Google Earth?
I probably would if I were writing a contemporary book, but for the past, it's really hard because you don't know how much changed, and so that makes it difficult. In Oxford, since I've been there and walked all the streets, I know the flavor and the feel of the place, and some of the colleges I know very well. And so I, instead of using a tool like Google Earth, I relied on my pictures from the trip and my imagination. And I found that worked really well. It's easier to set a book somewhere that you've made up than it is to set it somewhere as well known as Oxford.
Right. Okay, we're here with Gigi Vandegrift, and if you'd like to call into the show, I know we have a lot of shy people out there, but there are some people listening. If you'd like to give us a call into the show, we'll get you on. It's 914-219-0868. And talk to us about Catherine. What was it like to create her, and is there any of you in her character?
Oh, I think there's a lot of me in her character. She is kind of an anomaly because she is a woman who has been successful as a scholar in the 1930s, which was very unusual at the time. She was also a published poet, and that's even more unusual. But I wanted to have somebody who really excelled at what she did, but who had insecure side to her, and who had this disaster in her past that she was trying to get over in terms of her relationship with Rafe, her former, well, he was kind of a man that came in and out of her life. She hadn't resolved it yet, but you don't really know what it is with Rafe that's so difficult until right near the end of the book. And she has this kind of love-hate relationship with another Oxford professor, and with an Oxford professor, not another one. Anyway, and they really get off to a bad start because he's given her book of her first book of poetry a bad review, and he doesn't. He's not a big fan of hers, but he likes her as a person, and. So anyway, they have this ongoing feud about her work and his opinion of it. And he's a 19th century literary historian. And so he that's his area, and hers is 20th century literature, and so British literature. And so anyway, they have kind of a feud going that the reader is, I hope, interested in, and then her old love comes back, and there's a little triangle going on. And anyway, Catherine gets pretty fed up with both of them after a little while, and I think I think I had to have a certain level of confidence in myself as a person in order to write the book, because Catherine is a very confident person, but she does have this side to her that is very vulnerable. And that's the kind of character that I like. I like somebody who is forthright and strides out to accomplish things, but gets tripped up by their own vulnerabilities. And so that's Catherine.
Yeah, the interesting thing with us writers, when we sit down and create a character, sometimes we control them, and sometimes they have more of a tendency to control us and where the story is going. Do you use an outline to do that with your plot?
No.
Or do you just do it as it flows?
I'm a pantser. I fly by the seat of my pants. I create my characters, and then I let the characters create the story. So I very much go along with what I think that they would be feeling, you know, at any. And that's hard to write a mystery that way. You end up doing a lot of rewriting because
right.
you figure out where you're going in the middle of the book, and then you have to go back and change a lot of things to go with the plot as you're finally discovering it.
Right. I've interviewed over 100 authors on this show, and I can't think of one that uses an outline. But if you go to, it escaped my mind, but there's an author, his name is Jim. That's all I can remember right now. But he's a very famous author, and he uses an outline. In fact, I took an online course with him, and he said that you should use an outline, but there's a lot of authors that don't. So I find it interesting that we just kind of let the story go where it's going to go. And I think my opinion is it's the best way to do it. So in your more than 30 books, and boy, you've been busy that you've written, which one is your favorite? I know you mentioned Last Waltz. Would that be it?
Yeah, that's my favorite. I don't think I'll ever write another Last Waltz because it took most of my life. So I don't have that much time to devote to another book.
That was
my favorite.
Which would be your second book?
My second book? I never really thought about that. Probably... my Catherine series. I'm really liking that. And my favorite book in the Catherine series is probably the one I'm writing right now. It's called The Hollywood Murders. Catherine and Harry go to teach summer school at UCLA and become involved in a murder that takes place, several murders that takes place, that take place in 1930s Hollywood. And that's been an absolute ball to research. It's just been so much fun. And I'm from Southern California and grew up there. And so, you know, it's just been fun to research all the, what everything was like in the 1930s when LA was just kind of getting off the ground. And that's just been a really fun book. And to have Catherine and Harry be placed in a situation where everybody around them is acting a role and they don't know who the real person is behind that role and who is really a murderer, because they're all acting. Everybody's acting all the time. And it's really been a fun book to write. So I don't know, but I think I have a friend that's a really good writer, and her favorite book is the one she's writing, Enthusiasm.
It's also kind of fun that when you're doing research, you'll find something that's completely off the mark of where your book is, and you decide, wow, that sounds like something interesting that I could use for a story in the future. I know I've gone off track a couple times, and that's what I love about researching, is that you always find a little bit of gold out there somewhere when you're not really looking for it. And it takes you off in a tangent, sometimes away from your book, but it's fun. It's fun doing that.
Serendipity. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that is fun.
Serendipity. In your writing, you use well-placed humor, and I mentioned it in my review, and you use words like canoodling to point out the picture of a romantic encounter. How far do you go in describing a romantic scene, and how do you know when to pull back and trust your readers to paint their own pictures?
Oh, that's a really hard question. I find it very difficult to write romantic scenes. I think that's the reason I write so many books that are British, because British mysteries don't really go into a lot of detail. They leave a lot up to the imagination of the reader. And they don't elaborate on a lot of things. And before writing this series of mysteries, I wrote 13 Regency romances. And they all, of course, take place in England. And during the time that Jane Austen wrote, that's the period, the Regency period. And I was so glad I was writing that period, because I could kind of escape really tense situations by remembering Jane Austen and how she pulled it off. And she wrote some of the greatest romances, and Jane Eyre as well. So
did a great job with canoodling. It only needed one word. It needed one word. You described about a half an hour of the scene, I think. But that was great. I found that really entertaining. And also, before we tuned into you, we had George Saunders on. He mentioned editing, and he talked about trusting your readers. In other words, don't insult your readers. So you can use words that they can use their own imaginations to paint a scene where you don't need to get into the graphics of that. But I think that's something that a lot of authors that are probably around our age, I'm 65, I think you're somewhere around there. You don't need to tell me how old you are. But
you're right, though.
But you kind of get away from all the detail because you don't really need it. And I think it's an insult to the reader if you if you have to use all those details. Some people like it. Sometimes it fits in certain novels. I was just finished one, which was very graphic, but I think it had to be because of the content and the genre of the writing. They needed to do that. But I find it interesting that people can use one or two words to get people through that kind of action, if you want to call it that. And I think you did a fantastic job with that. Who are your favorite authors?
Well, I'm really a 19th century girl. My favorite authors of all time are all 19th century. Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. I really like the heavy hitters. But for today's writers, I really like Susanna Kearsley a lot. And I like a friend of mine, Nicole Van. She's actually an indie author like I am now. I haven't always been an indie author. I started writing and publishing my own stuff when I was in 2012. But I started my publishing career in 1990, and everything up until 2012 was published by traditional publishers. But anyway, Nicole has always written and been published by herself, and she is fabulous. She is such a good writer, and I enjoy her so much. And just trying to think of some others. I really like Dorothy Sayers, and these are mystery writers. My favorite mystery writers are Dorothy Sayers, Neil Marsh, and Marjorie Allingham. And they all wrote in the Golden Age, the period during which I write my mysteries. And I just love them. I have read all their books countless times.
Uh-huh.
So that writing in that period is just a natural thing for me. It's a natural voice that I can just put on because I've read the books so many times.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you think reading is important to be a good writer?
Oh, I think it's essential. I think it's essential. I think that's what keeps you up to the mark. If you're just in love with your own writing and you don't care how anybody else does it, you're going to miss a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so you have put together more than 30 books, and I'm not sure if you do, but how do you handle book reviews? How many stars would you give An Oxford Murder? Two questions there.
Probably 4 stars. It's gotten 5 stars from a lot of readers, but I don't think it's that good. I mean, it's as good as I could make it, but I'm not confident enough about my writing to really say it's really good. I don't know many authors that are.
No, you're right. And I'm glad you say that, because with your experience, you know, I've gotten my first historical fiction novel out regarding my grandfather in the 1920s, New York City bootlegging days. He had some kind of a dark past down there, and it's been interesting to get that book published after all these years. And I still am very critical of my writing, but a lot of people say they've given me 5 stars. I've gotten several 5-star reviews. But do you ever get any, you know, like any 1 or 2 star reviews? And how do you process?
Oh, yeah. That's really difficult when that happens. I got one for An Oxford Murder. It was like 2 stars, and it was like the second review that I got. and it just blew me out of the water. It took me almost a year to get over that. And
wow.
Now, well, it was really unfair. It was the reader was somebody who obviously never read my type of fiction. I don't really know why he read the book, or even if he did read the book, because it came out when the book had only been out for 2 days. And so, you know, it was just so hard for me to get past that. And bad reviews are really heartbreaking. They just really, really are. And they can really subvert your efforts. And so I don't read reviews anymore.
Right.
I just don't.
You think you've got a thicker skin now that you've been, you know, I mean, you've gotten awards and you're, you know, you've got a lot of very good reviews. Could you handle a 2-star now, or do you think it would affect you the same way?
I think it would affect me the same way. I just care much too much what other people think of my writing. But, you know, have you ever heard of the editor Max Perkins? He was Hemingway and Fitzgerald's editor. And he said any writer that's worth their salt is questions his writing and whether it's good or not. And that was what he felt was his job, was to help Hemingway and Fitzgerald to get through their self-doubt, because it's just a very common thing for writers. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that those two men would have felt that way. But it's what probably what made them keep getting better and better. And anyway, so I always love Max Perkins' books. I had a book of his letters, and I don't know what happened to it. I can't find it. But it was his letters to these authors, and it was just incredible. It was so interesting. I don't personally think I will ever get over my fear of bad reviews.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, because, you know, I've looked at some of your writing and I read a lot about you, about the books that you've written. And it, I guess it makes us, you know, newbies kind of feel a little bit better about feeling so horrible sometimes, because even the best of them, are feeling bad about a bad review. I often wonder if Stephen King ever gets that way, but my guess is that he just keeps punching on, and that's what you got to do to keep going in your craft. And so that's interesting, though, and I'm glad you said that, because I'm not alone, and I know somebody that's a very good writer like yourself that's in the same boat as I am. So what are, besides writing, what are some of your favorite things to do other than writing?
I think probably my very favorite thing to do is play with my grandkids. And then after that, my favorite thing to do is to travel. I love to travel, and it inspires my writing. And it's just all in there, you know, all in my head. I can go to so many places in my imagination because I've been so blessed to be able to travel. And it's just a really high priority for me. I don't care that much about clothes. I don't care that much about, I like to have nice things around me, but I'm not into having a home tour type house. I just, as far as material things go, I have what I need, and that's really all I want. Everything beyond that, what I spend my money on is travel. And it's hard because I've gotten more physically frail in the last few years with really bad arthritis, and so I can't travel as much as I want to. And I just, so I'm living in my memories a lot from all the places that we went. And
right.
And my husband is a fantastic photographer. And so we have endless photographs of everywhere we've ever gone. And it's amazing how those photographs can just bring it all back.
Right.
So
we have a common friend, and we won't mention her last name, Susan. And
right.
have you thought about going over there to visit her? I believe that's a very beautiful place in the springtime.
Yeah, it is beautiful. And I know she'd like me to come. I've been to Amsterdam, but it was before I met Susan. And so I don't know. I would like to meet her somewhere where we have common ancestors. I think that would really be fun. She's very much into family history, and so am I. And pardon me? Hello?
She does a very good job.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a really fascinating person, and I'm always interested in her insights into the places that she travels. She knows so many languages and just has, being European, she has so much more firsthand information about a lot of the places I write about. And so anyway, she would be a really fun person to travel with.
Right. Do you set aside a time and a place to write? And do you use an online, or is it more a flow of thoughts, which we'd already talked about, which it is? But do you go to a special place in your home to do writing?
Yeah, I've switched places back and forth. I don't like to always go into. I have an office, but because of my arthritis, I can't sit at a desk anymore. So I have kind of gone to different places in my house, and now I have a writing recliner, and I use my laptop, and I'm in the sunniest room in my house because I love the sunshine, and I write every morning, and my brain kind of turns to mush about 2 o'clock, so I write until 2 every day, and I plan all my appointments, all my visits, everything that I do with my friends, I plan it for after 2, and so that I have that time every day, and it's really important to me. I run through a book called A Writer's Time, and he said that your writing is only going to be as important as you let it be, and if you aren't committed to your writing, you can't expect anybody else to be. So you need to take yourself seriously as a writer and give the time to it. And if you have to pay somebody to do the things that you would be doing at that time, like cleaning your house, that shows where your investment, that shows about your investment in yourself. And so, but the, you know, I couldn't always do this. I used to have little kids. And so when I had little kids, it was nap time and nighttime was when I would write. And then it was when they were in school, that was my writing time. So
right.
All through my life, I've had to adjust to my situation. But but I'm pretty committed that way.
Very good. A lot of writers get their early morning time in, and that's also interesting, where as we go along during the day, our minds get more muddied than they are when we first wake up. That's when I like to write.
Exactly.
So what's next for Gigi Vandergriff? What, you mentioned working on a book now. Is there anything after that?
I've kind of got an idea for the characters that I want to have in my next book, but I don't know what the mystery is going to be yet. The way my husband and I have a great thing that we do together, we kind of collaborate a little bit on characters. and we go to this cafe that we like, and we lay out index cards, and we just invent characters. And it's really fun. And then I let the characters tell me the story. And so finding characters for my new book is what I will be doing as soon as I finish editing this book.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That's interesting, too. I have to keep that in mind, mark that down for something maybe I can do to develop some characters. Where can readers find you on the Internet?
On Amazon.com. They can find me. They can Gigi Vandegrift, and I've got a Writer Central page on there. If you just click my name underneath one of my titles, it will take you to my author page, and it has all my books there. And then also you can follow me on BookBub, and there's a lot of reviews on BookBub of people that like my books and decide to write a review. There aren't bad reviews on BookBub. That's one good thing. then I have a website, which is going to be changed a little bit. It's more geared toward my romances, but it does have all my mysteries on it. And my website is ggvandegrift.com. Very easy.
Very good. Any parting words of advice to any writers out there?
Just do what you can to feed your writer. Read good books. Watch good shows on TV that are not exploitive or sensational, but have really good character development. And I think if you write good characters, you're going to write good books.
Very good. Gigi, it's been a pleasure. We are winding down here with a few minutes left. And I want to thank you for all that you've done for the readers out there and the many books that you have written. And I really enjoyed your time here on the Writer's Lounge and like to have you back sometime in the future if you wouldn't mind doing that.
Oh, that'd be fun, Tom.
That's great.
I appreciate your having me on.
And that's great. And I've met a new friend.
Yes.
Okay.
Good luck with your new book.
Well, thank you very much, Gigi, and thank you again. And take care.
Thank you. Bye.
And there she goes, Gigi Vandegrift. Again, her book, An Oxford Murder. You can find that wherever books are sold, as they say. And so that brings us to the final chapter here on the Writer's Lounge. The next show coming up will be Monday, March 22nd, 2021 at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that is 1 week from today. Just as a side note here with the shows, we will broadcast every other Monday after next Monday. So that'll be the key show. And then you can set your calendars every other week. On Mondays at 7, we'll be here on the Writer's Lounge. Next up, as I said, on March 22nd at 7 p.m., Kristen McKiernan wrote Sunder in Time. This is a rich and interesting tale told about time travel, but it's also a story about love, family, and decisions that will have to be made to save or not to save history as we know it. This book is a top shelf winner. I look forward to the next book in this series, and I look forward to having Kristen McKiernan as a guest on the Writer's Lounge. So until next time, if you are an author or reader, open up that book and let the story begin. See you next time on the Writer's Lounge.
If they asked me, I could write a book. the way you walk and whisper and look. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make a lot.